Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio today, we are going to run out of time before we probably get halfway through his life as an artist, as a multi-artist. But my guest in the studio today, Dale Parity, has been featured in Louisiana Life magazine, Country Roads magazine. He and his work has been featured at the Monroe Folklife Festival, Festival of Cadillan, New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, the Magnolia Moundfall Festival, which we're going to talk about a specific project that he did there, and at Evangeline Longfellow State Park. He's done a number of art shows with his artwork where he uses an old form of creating. And we're also going to talk about music and a bit of film. So welcome, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
It's good to be on the show.
That's what I said. You know, with someone who is a triple threat, you know, when you look at artists and what they're involved in, you have three really major art forms that have played a significant, you know, role in your life. And, you know, depending on the time or your age, they've kind of all sounds like they've come in and out and kind of intertwined a bit. But I'm curious, when you look at your life and being young, do you remember some specific times or experience where art, whether whatever form that was in, made a pretty significant presence in your life when you thought, okay, well, this is going to be a part of me?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I took an art class. But I always thought, well, if you just can't draw well, you're not an artist. That's how limited my view was.
Sure.
I didn't include sculpture or any of the other things like that. But actually, getting into art, I had a lot of people that inspired me. I'm from Lake Charles, where I grew up and went to school and everything, although I was born in Abbeville here.
Yeah.
And Charles Kimball is the brother of Danny Kimball, the drummer that we all know from here and used to play in the band The Bad Roads, occasionally get together.
Red Beans and
Rye. That was the first band I
saw. But Bad Roads was out of Lake Charles.
Yeah, and that was the first band I saw, and they had, you know, a national hit. And they were the first band I saw in the arena there, where they played basketball, and they set up and they played a song. I'm going, oh, this is cool. I want to do this.
Yeah.
Because I'd always been into percussion and drumming. All my books have pencil marks all over where I'm drumming on them, you know. Should have been doing homework.
Yeah.
But
not necessarily. That,
yeah,
that was its own kind of homework.
That was my homework,
yeah.
Home play or whatever.
That's right.
And so I had all these artists around me to inspire me to go, hey, you can do this too, you know.
And now Danny's brother, Charles, mm-hmm. he did visual artwork.
Well, Charles is also a multi-talented guy too. He's the first drum set I got to where I could hang out on, and he'd put on something in the stereo and play it, and I'd practice along with that because I never had any of my own drums to do that with. And he was also a great graphic artist. The old Jay's posters that
Lounge.
I mean, it was great graphic, including Jay's itself, all the old cypress slabbings that were on the front with the picture of the rooster and, you know, on the front.
And that was Charles that did that.
And Charles did that.
Ah.
And he did stained glass also. He was a very good stained glass, but he was also into architecture, which was another. So he himself inspired a lot of and other people, you know, around Lafayette. You can talk to a lot of people that he's inspired. And, definitely one of the big influences in my life. And
interesting. So, now, with you talked about earlier before we started the show, your dad has instilled a number of things in you, but he worked as a projectionist.
When he was young, yes, his family was very poor. His father died when he was 9 years old. His father was deaf, and he inherited that too, so he was deaf. But he came a long way from a poor family. They moved to Kinder, Louisiana, I think with a box of salt, some crackers, I don't know, nothing much, and somebody gave him some greens, or maybe they gave him the salt, whatever it was. They came up from hard times, so the mother had to haul mail in the mornings with a contract to the train in Elton, Louisiana. And my dad was a projectionist. Of course, you know, I love the movies, and that's one of the things that got me started off being a filmmaker as well, because my dad bought an old 60-millimeter projector and had old black and white films, Wild Bill Cody with the subtitles, and Three Stooges, Walt Disney, Donald Duck. And I remember when we were in the washing room, and I had a white T-shirt on, and crank it up. Let's see if it goes. So I stood in front of it, and Mickey Mouse is dancing on my heart. And ever since then, I've been into films. So
isn't that
home movies, stop motion, animation. I bugged my dad one day to use his camera. It was one of the little press-to-talk, to shoot it. You press the button.
Yeah.
And I'm doing this clay animation of a dinosaur, and he's moving. You got to move it a little bit, take a picture, you move it again, you know. And it got stuck, and it and the film's going bad. My dad's going, just roll with it, you know. So I'm going like this with the thing. This is not what I wanted, Dad. You broke my camera now.
You know? Do you know what's interesting? But you actually made the figurines out of clay.
Yeah, so I guess that was so my delve into sculpture, you know.
Well, but that's because so much of the work that a lot of people know you for is your use of bousillage. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that back then, I mean, there's that that's a real similar material. You may not have had that same mm-hmm. mix, but huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and then I got into the clay. I guess my grandpa was digging a well one day, and there was some great clay come out, and so I got a big sack of it, and I kept it by the corner of the washroom, and I was going to do something. My mom was like, what you going to do with that? I'm going to do something. I don't know when. It'll be about 25, 30 years, but I'm going to do something with it.
But that's where the idea
But that's where it started. I thought, oh, this is cool. Look at this stuff. You don't see that on the topsoil. So, but my start in bousillage doing it actually came from working on the set of Bélisaire the Cajun.
Okay.
Which is a story – takes place in the 1850s.
That was
Glenn Petrie.
Yeah, Petrie, he pronounces it, yeah.
And our own Louisiana filmmaker here. And he had the story. It was about the wealthy planter class, and they were kind of driving the Cajuns out, accusing them of stealing cattle or whatever. And they would kind of, like the cattle barons did, you just accuse them of stealing your cattle or whatever.
Sure, sure.
You know? I mean, if it was a rich guy with a bunch of cattle around and he's got so many and they wander onto my property, it's barbecue time. Eat the evidence. We're living hand to mouth here, bro. And you're going to run us out to Texas?
Yeah.
So on the film, I got to do a bousillage chimney.
Well, how did you get involved in that? How did he know about you?
Well, I'd had my filmmaking background. I mean, I used to work at TV station that I had my own advertising agency where I did films. For banks, hot air balloons, different things.
Yeah.
And so that's how I kind of got involved in it. And I can't quite remember, but I was keeping tabs on, well, Glenn's in town. He's doing this. So I stopped by at one of the meetings, and nobody wanted to volunteer for doing the bousillage. I still didn't know what it was. And playing with mud doesn't sound very glamorous in movies. Like everybody wanted to be around Armand DeSante or Robert Duvall or the people who were in the film. And so I started building on it and doing research about bousillage, and because I didn't know anything about it. It's mud and moss. Well, it sounds like some slimy, nasty goo you pull off the bayou bank, you mix it with some moss, and you throw it in your walls.
Sure.
No, these are plantation homes were made like this as well, just fancier plaster. Cajuns just use like a whitewash made
out of ash. Well, that's interesting. You volunteered and then learned how.
And I did a technique. I just kind of discovered on my own. Glenn's going, we got 3 days. It's a cheap, low-budget film. We ain't got all the time to spend on the world on this.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I'm going to have to do what they call nogging. They would take big chunks of clay and we'd fit it in. Of course, it's Hollywood. We got to make it look like a chimney. So I would use burlap and a little bit of moss, but as long as it looked cool from the outside. And then there'd be times when we wouldn't be doing anything, but we were at Longfellow Evangeline Park in St. Martinsville. And I'd find bones and feathers and stones, and some of the moss would be cured naturally. I'd find the black strands. And so I'd hang up the bone, and I'd put a feather in it or a little rock where you could see through it, just messing with different stuff like that. And I added it. It kind of added to the gree-gree effect. So now when I look back on the film, I look and I go, oh, look, there's one of my pieces hanging right there.
Well,
so if you look, you'll see something. So that was really the beginning of it.
I'll have to go back and watch that because, when people who know your work now and see it there's so much of what you just talked about is incorporated in all your different pieces. I mean, there's all of those natural things. Well, that's interesting. So that came back from there.
I think my head just went out here a little bit. But, that's how it all started. And then now some of my later pieces that I'm doing, it kind of struck me, I love music, so why don't I make a bousillage guitar? And so that's what I ended up doing. And so that's one of my pieces. Bill Fontenot told me, he said, Harry Schultz, a fiddle player, old Cajun fiddle player, made his own electric pickup out of some nails wrapped with copper wire. And I thought, there's my next folk art piece right there. And so so that's my current piece that I have right now that I just finished, and it looks pretty cool.
Okay, back up a second, because we were switching out headphones there. So, did you say – were you talking about Harry Schultz? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That he had used. Okay.
Yeah, that he had made – I thought he meant for a guitar pickup, but apparently it was for a fiddle pickup too in the days when, you know, amplification. Sometimes they would run the amplifier off of an old – off the cars.
Sure, sure.
You know, if there
sure.
was no electricity there at these different places where people would play.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Your work has gone from – volunteering to figure out how to do it on that film, mm-hmm. you know, to incorporating a lot of natural. I mean, it's very spiritual when you look at your work too.
Thank you.
I mean, there's that real element of and I don't. Is that something that you think about when you're creating? I don't know if it's all the natural elements. It just gives it that very spiritual feel.
I guess things started. I don't know. If, I'm trying to think of the artist's name now. But basically, spending time in nature, you know, I go hunting, fishing, or you go to Wiskachittle in the sandbars, and you
sure.
find things, and I just start arranging stuff, you
yeah,
know. It was
yeah.
basically just arranging things. And I guess was my connection with it. Andy Goldsworthy is the name that comes to mind, if you've ever seen any of his stuff.
Okay.
He does a similar kind of thing. But I didn't know about all this at that time. It was just a way to, you know, to connect.
Yeah.
And I didn't have big money to spend on, you know, buying paints and brushes and canvas and all that. And I was going, what can I do that doesn't cost me a lot that I can get? Plus, it's a connection between the bousillage wall building that I've done on restoring about 8 houses.
Well,
let's
back up a second.
Connection.
How did it – what was the path that you took from – you know, you started figuring out how to do that for that
mm-hmm.
film. And then what was the sequence where – you then started – I mean, you started doing that professionally for those old plantation homes.
Actually, Denise Harding is my wife. Her mother, Margaret Harding, is a very multi-talented artist as well, a great painter, and just full of the Cajun culture. You know, that she grew up in – we lived right behind the 1820s Sidney Morton home where, you know, when Denise came from California, you know, here they come. This is a new culture. And
sure.
so she was kind of wrapped up in all this. And but her mother and has her uncle Chester Martin. Some people may know of him. Used to be in real estate, but he had a bunch of old beams that were out of an old building that had bousillage. And so we're looking around all the old stuff, and I see some beams there, and I said, "What you gonna do with that stuff there? I've never really seen it because you don't even see the walls when you go into old bousillage houses. It's usually covered with plaster or
sure.
whitewash, so you don't really see the
yeah,
wall unless
yeah.
you find an old house or something where it's kind of washed away." So I said, "You know, I think I'm gonna start learning this bousillage technique, not just the chimneys, but the making of the walls are done very similarly. There's little sticks called barreaux that go about every 5 or 6 inches horizontally." And you make these loaves of clay and moss. It's a muddy clay, but it's clay.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have a kind of the Bayou Vermilion brownish clay, and also this is a grayish clay is very common around here. They mix that with the moss. Now, the Indians did it with raw moss. The Cajuns, because they were much thinner, smaller walls, about 4 inches thick, used the cured moss, which takes about a month of rotting it and keeping it wet.
Sure.
Then you can also make your stuffing for your mattresses. You can make cordage to make rope. And so there's a lot of things that go into it.
So how did you learn all of that? Did you go work with some folks or you just
yourself
studied?
No, nobody was around because okay. nowadays, you know, people always say, "Oh, well, Dale, you're the expert." I said, "No, all the experts are dead."
Yeah.
I'm just I've brought it up to a level. I still learn things. I go, "Oh, the barreaux were made out of white oak." Learned that from Eddie Kazi, who I helped him and his students build part of his modern home that is incorporating different ways to use bousillage
sure.
and airflow, which I'm also very interested in, these finding new ways to use bousillage.
Exactly.
You know, keep it in our culture here.
So with the plantation homes, you also worked one of the things you had talked about before, like I said, before we came on the air, is you worked on Louis Michaud's house. Mm-hmm. And that was a nice experience for you.
It's of all the historical homes are fun to do because, you know, I've got my hands in the wall. It's 1790, you know, the last time somebody touched this. And you see all the old marks and everything, and it's a great feeling to know you've restored something that's going to stay in our state heritage here. But I also wanted to bring it into the future. And so I wanted to combine art and architecture. So I call it art-architecture. So Louis' house was the best because what we did, we took cypress saplings instead of the squared hewn beams that were used in the traditional homes. And more like what you see out west in the kivas and that kind of thing with adobe, which is a straw and clay. And then we found these old telephone pole insulators. People probably don't know what I'm talking about now. You see them at probably antique shops.
The glass?
Different color. Yeah, kind of cone-shaped looking thing, kind of lens-like. So we put those in the wall. So day or night, inside or out, you got light things happening through the wall right by the kitchen countertop. And little niches in the wall, like a little place, and they have their – French coins, might be some rocks or ceramics or using clay to paint on the wall, a little niche there where to keep
the votive objects. Yeah, I mean, the wall becomes a piece of
artwork. Yeah, little votive objects within it and stuff. So that whole idea, plus using native clays, like I did one home where I used blackjack vine. A guy said, I got some 1790 beams over a fireplace, and I used blackjack vines, and I used a brownish Bayou Vermilion clay, and from Bayou Nipiquet is a real red clay.
And now where's that by? River. Oh, from the Red River.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all that. That's where our deposits came from that are here. They're just more chocolate colored because the sediment and everything. But so I used two tones and I would kind of wash it away. And so I got – I said, man, you can have color in the house. It doesn't have to just be whitewashed. People did that in the days because there wasn't much light and it helped reflect the light in.
Yeah.
But it's mostly a cooling element because what happens with bousillage, once it's dry – at nighttime in the summers here, all the humidity gets absorbed into the wall, and then the daytime breezes blow through, and you have an evaporative cooling.
Oh,
and then in the wintertime, you have thermal mass from the heat of your bousillage chimney.
Sure.
Heat into there. So it's a pretty unique material.
Oh, yeah. Fascinating. Well, we're gonna take a short break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about some of the other art forms that you've gotten involved with bousillage. But we're going to listen – one of the art forms that you have gone back to pursuing right now is music. And you've brought in some cuts from a band right now that you're working with – named at this point Double Dog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that project or the guys involved?
Yeah. Bronson Sarver, who used to play with the Amazing Nuns and Neurostottle, moved into a little house right at the end of our road. We have about 7 acres of woods. We live surrounded by the city with a nice little sanctuary there for creatures.
Sure.
And Bronson was into farming. His whole backyard is into is growing stuff. He really wants to be a big-time grower and service the community like that. And so I get in there and I see, well, you got some music equipment here, you know. I don't have to go all the way out to Bosco to play, you know. It's right here,
Yeah.
And he was getting – I heard him play some stuff on the guitar, you know, but he was a drummer for the bands before. But he had played some guitar, but his guitars were kind of like my first guitars. They were kind of hand-me-downs, or they weren't in the best shape. But I had a guitar that I just bought. So the guitar that I was using before, a hollow body, I said, Bronson, this is a better guitar. Man, I want to work out some kind of trade out. I said, I see you got some talent, and you're into writing songs and doing this. So why don't I, you know, you can have my guitar. We'll trade out, or we'll figure out something. I said, you need to do this, you know. Because at this stage of my life, I love seeing people where that have talent and – you know, and help
and go for it.
And me too.
Yeah,
because now I get a chance. We're writing songs together. Before, I've got stuff I've written for years, never did anything. It was always like long poems that could be changed into songs.
Sure.
And I do my improvisation because I don't seem to have enough discipline to sit down and do it. But that's my new challenge at this time is to kind of, okay, Dale, settle on one thing, get one song down. It doesn't have to be a masterpiece. Three chords in the truth is all you need. You know, keep it simple, stupid.
There you go.
So it's been great, you know, doing this. Now, on the cut you're going to hear, Ken Robertson is the owner of the Multibus Studios, but he's also a great musician himself, plays the bass and the lead on these songs.
Okay.
But we have some two new members of the band, Cody Stafford and Doug Scarsdale are going to be helping us. He was a former member of Neurostottle too. And all they've played before in front of people. I never went to a recording studio before. I'm getting used to click tracks and all that.
Sure.
So it was all new to me. So
yeah.
I'm thank y'all for having patience with me. But
we'll
hear what we did.
Well, let's listen to the first cut, and this is Sugar.
There's only one thing a man wants in this world.
All right. That was Double Dog. That was the song Sugar, and featuring our guest in the studio today, Dale Parity. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette right here at Cypress Lake Studios. And as I say each week, tip of the hat to the folks out there who continue to help support us. We've got Make It Pretty Easy. We've got the donate button on the website you can go to, and your assistance helps the station continue to play all the national programming that we bring in from NPR, as well as so many wonderful locally produced programs. So thanks again for all of you continue to help us out. My guest in the studio today, as I mentioned, Dale Parity, is a really talented artist. We've been talking during the first half of the show about his involvement really with the use of Boussiage, and whether that is restoring some old plantation homes or the artwork that he creates. It's really played quite a role in his life. And it's interesting, Dale, with, you know, the music side of you too, you know, what you mentioned earlier about some of the sculptures that you do now. I mean, they're beautiful instruments, you know, the guitars and everything you do. If people haven't, I know you mentioned Louis Michaud earlier. For folks out there who really listen, pay attention to music, on the Vermilion Air album was one of your sculptures. And it's the gentleman, it's the mask with the accordion.
Yes, the guy playing the accordion on there with the palmetto bellows on there.
With the palmetto. Oh, yeah, that's what the bellows were made out of.
Yeah, the hair is made out of the cured black moss, and, of course, the bousillage for the face and the hands.
Yeah.
And the base upon which this all fits on, too, because it's a dimensional piece.
Sure. You know,
cypress bark was used for the accordion part of it.
Yeah.
Just different little found objects.
When you talk about the cured moss, is that just the natural process of it aging, or do you actually have to then do something with it?
Well, it can, because once it falls in the ground, of course, it totally rots away after a while if you don't stop it during the curing process. But sometimes you look around underneath an oak tree where you see moss has fallen, where it's beginning to kind of decay into the ground. The moisture that happens there is beginning that process, so the outer gray part rots away. And if you ever look at raw moss, skin it back, you'll see there's a little brown fiber in there, kind of translucent. Not very strong at that point. But once the gray outer layer is rotted away, you end up with a strong, dark fiber.
Okay.
Used to suture wounds during the Civil War.
Ropes
made out of it, different things. But that's
really
the process. Indians used to soak it in the bayou to let it rot like that for
Got
a while.
It.
It takes about a month, 6 weeks. You
okay.
can also partially bury it. There's different ways. You can boil it and dry it. That doesn't totally do it. But on the house I did in Natchitoches at Oakland Plantation, did two structures there. That's how we did it, because it takes a lot of preparation. Nowadays, you don't think about all the labor intensity that goes into this stuff.
Yeah.
Not just once you have it, mixing it, which isn't like being stuck in a mud pit and trying to get out of it all day, because you're there mixing it by foot.
Yeah.
That's what they call the tacherons, the guys who get into the tacherons. The tacherons,
okay.
And it was fun because at Louis, you know, Louis got his fiddle out there, his moss hanging from it. He walks on the porch and he's got mud and moss, looks like slippers on his feet. And, you know, everybody was having fun. You know, you can't have fun while you work.
That's
you know?
Right, that's right.
It's like the old time way they used to do it in Cajun country here.
So now when you create some of the pieces you have now, what's the process? Is there any sketching with that, or is it you just start working with your hands?
Sometimes I'll do a light sketch. Usually I just kind of know what I want.
Yeah, you see it.
Yeah, I see it. Now I'll trace out, you know, the size I want it to be. It's going to shrink a little bit. I make an armature for it to hold on to.
Okay. It's an armature that's like a frame?
It's like
type
the bone,
thing?
Yeah. It's like a little frame that holds it on in place.
Okay.
And then I make sort of a little sandwich of the material.
Yeah.
And then I'll start shaping it. And then,
like for your guitars, that's what
you
do. Yeah,
for the
okay.
guitars. And then I'll start adding the objects as it starts to firm up. I'll start adding the pieces in where they're going to go. And then I'll glue them in and then finish it off and then kind of make it look old, kind of rub it off a little bit like it's been played a bunch and make it look real ancient.
And there's no when that piece is finished, you know, different from, you know, folks that work with other forms of clay, there's no heating, there's no process. It's just natural.
Yeah, and it's not fired, you know. There is no fire. Now, the Tfungchi Indians did make a fired pottery with bousillage, but
okay.
what I do is I just let it air dry up to a point. Then I take it out in the sun once it's pretty much dried all it's going to do, because it'll warp and crack. I like some of the warp and crack as long as it doesn't structurally interfere with the integrity of the piece. And then I'll put a light sealant on it after I use native clays also to paint onto it.
Okay.
So I'll use different tone for the base, and then I'll do another paint and I'll rub that off. And then I'll paint all the little designs on it, lightning bolts or whatever. And, and then I'll add all the other little pieces, you know, deer antler, bones, feathers, whatever.
Have you ever taught a class in that?
Well, not in the school. What I do is, and I just finished one at Jean Lafitte. I did two classes this summer. I love teaching the children, especially in the small control groups, where because all it takes is a few people that are bored and don't want to do something to throw things off. And so the people that are into it want to do it.
Yeah.
So I give them a little disc, basically a little patty of it, pre-mixed, because a lot of these younger children take too much for them to get it the right way.
Sure.
And tell them to start with something simple like making a bowl, but they can make whatever they want. So
yeah.
It's probably one of the first times usually if you're playing with Play-Doh and the other stuff, you're going to squish up what you did and it's all gone, you know, and start over again. And you can do that with bousillage too, where you can reform it, you know. And so it's fun to see kids do something with their hands. It's different than
– And I'm wondering too, over the years, you know, I know that – like if you go out to Vermilionvale, you can go and view, you know, they'll have in I know one of the houses for sure where they've kept it open, no plaster, so you can see the bousillage. Do you, over the years, have you seen where there are that's an art that more people have picked up now?
Well, I talked to someone recently who's actually doing the houses, but they're doing, you know, what I never could do, make an actual business out of it and make money out of it.
Sure,
you know? I did only a few over the years.
Yeah.
You know? But as far as an art form, I don't know of anybody else. I'd love for somebody to do it. I encourage that. But even if it's just for, like, the kids to make something.
Yeah, that's a nice thing you're exposing them to.
But maybe somebody is doing that and I don't know.
Yeah.
If you're doing that, let me know.
Yeah, I was just curious, you know, just when you go back to the time of when you first got involved, you know, when that film came out, that, you know, it's not like there was a whole roster of people who were, you know, doing bousillage back then. That I'm just curious if that's something where, you know, I know a few people who are working on the homes and things, but...
Yeah, and when I got my showing, I was doing the Jazz and Heritage Festival, and I brought some of my stuff, and I had this massive wall I brought over there, a 7-foot wall of the actual beams, and did a whole corner.
Oh, you would travel with a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over the years, I've gotten it much, much smaller. I go, okay, they got two rungs here. They can figure out how the house is done, you know. I'm getting too old for this.
Yeah, start big, though.
Yeah.
You know?
So, but then Arthur Rogers saw me and said, I'd like to have your stuff in the gallery. He said, now, people are not familiar with this art form, so they might not, you know.
Yeah.
They're kind of leery of new stuff, new art forms,
new
mediums. And I'm going, well, let's do it. Let's see.
Yeah.
And so I sold a few pieces and, you know, and I never went to art school. I mean, my friends, Charles Kimmel, they all went here, you know, to do their art. So I was just around people who were artists. Hardy Albritton's another great artist that I learned from. He's also stained glass, but also a good artist. But he didn't hold it over. I mean, this guy was a genius.
Yeah.
and just a really good art form. But all these people encouraged me to keep on. They might say, well, try using a little less. You know, it's not like you're building a house now. Use it as a texture. So I would start making little frames instead of big chunky things, you know, because I got to haul this stuff around.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting as you learn and watch other people how your art evolves, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, and stuff that's right in your face. I was going like, well, I love music. Why don't I make a guitar or accordion? Why did it never hit me to do that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, the time's right. You know, how I first knew of you was actually through film that you had done. And you have done a lot of the film that has come out of this area. Would Dirty Rice have been one of the first, or?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the chronology of all these things. Dirty Rice was one of the first. I did America's Most Wanted.
Now, how did that come about?
Miriam Fontenot called me from knowing me from Bel Air the Cajun.
Sure.
Actually, well, Bel Air the Cajun, I had a few little scenes in there. I was an extra.
Yeah.
But I really got the bug when Armand Asante walks in and I'm going, this is like it's real. You know,
yeah,
this is what
sure.
real actors bring to the thing, you know,
sure.
for us amateurs. And then it makes it easy because they're carrying the weight of the scene, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm going, ooh, I want to do more than just stand around and be an extra. You
yeah.
know? So that's when I decided to do that. And then she called with the
– I forgot about Miriam. She worked for – like did casting and those kinds of things.
Yeah, she was a dance instructor, Cajun
that's right,
dance
that's
and that
right.
kind of thing
okay.
too.
Yeah, yeah. So what was the America's Most Wanted? Did you have to audition for that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Nick Gomez, who did a few series of The Sopranos as well as two films of his own, Laws of Gravity and some other one I can't remember. Yes, I had to go audition, and they chose me. And I was glad for that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was fun working with them because we were doing one scene where I had to come into this bedroom area. The light was supposed to hit right across the side of me, and I was keep missing it, and I'm getting all uptight, you know, and he's getting uptight. You
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
I could tell he's getting frustrated, you know. We've done this 5 times, you know. We've got to do this in 3 days here.
Yeah.
And so he said
– and it's a recreation that they do, of,
yeah,
isn't it? Of
yeah.
A,
uh-huh. Well, what they think happened.
What they think happened right. for a crime. Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so I'm looking around. I'm going, it's just a small sliver of light. Can we make, you know, bigger something? So we're both looking around. I see a drinking cup, you know, one of those paper drinking cups about, you know, 8-10 inches high.
Sure.
And we almost bumped heads going down to get it because we're thinking the same thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
you just – you know, you don't go and order something from the hardware store. You just rip and run right there, you know. So I put it there and the scene went okay.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And was there any result from that show?
Well, the killer turned himself in Mesa, Arizona almost after killing another woman and child. Now, he just, you know, he killed this woman who was a prostitute here. I don't know if y'all remember the old Starlight Hotel when you come into Lafayette on the right there is where that happened.
So was it filmed in this area?
At the hotel where it happened.
Ah,
and,
okay.
And me and Michelle Boulay, who was in – played the part of the woman, did a little ceremony in down there. We didn't know if it was the same room or what, but it was in the same area. And we kind of like, let's hope we get this guy and nobody gets hurt in the process.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And that's what happened. And he even showed him – and I got another royalty for that. I think I got 4 royalties
when
on
they
it.
Did the follow-up.
Yeah, and the follow-up. So I got 4 checks. It was pretty neat because you're out in the country, you know, kind of living hand-to-mouth as an artist. And all of a sudden the check, hey, $635, we're going
wow,
eat out tonight.
That's right.
So that was fun working with Nick. And also did Dirty Rice with Pat Mear. I was a bartender in that one. And also in Sushi and Sauce Pecan is a story about Jerry McGee.
Sure.
He's doing this film about Dennis Menomadee. And so, you know, it's fun. One thing kind of leads to the other, you know,
yeah.
your connections and stuff. At the time, Jerry was in that film as well, but I didn't know he was quite the musician. I mean, he played with Elvis and Great Balls
that's
of Fire
right.
with Jerry
that's,
Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
Recorded Chris Christopher and Rita Coolidge.
That's incredible.
Just Barbara Streisand.
Right.
I mean, just a lot of people and a lot of talent. Very humble guy. I got to play with him I think 2 or 3 times we had a little jam there, so it was fun.
Well, what does acting bring to you that is different from sculpture in terms of what that art form brings to you?
As a kid, because my dad was a projectionist and I just loved movies, we had a free pass. My dad was a policeman, so he could – if they had trouble to drive in, they'd call him. You know, I never did, which
yeah,
is good.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom would put this water in a little jug. I remember we'd have a little glass of water, bring our own food and stuff in pajamas in those days. They had
that's
the playground
right.
up front and all that. So
that's
we could go
fun.
See movies for free. And so when you get back as kids, we'd reenact movies that we saw. So we would always
uh-huh,
just go,
cool.
oh, we'd call this movie. We had our favorite ones, you know, Boys War or something like this. You know, we'd have different things. And so it was just fun to improvise on it and just play.
Yeah.
Of course, when you're doing a movie and you're learning lines and it's not, you know, it's like, gee, now I'm freezing up. Before it was just like I'm just floating along with what's happening. We're having fun, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So now this is a little different. But that's how I got involved in it. And then when I was in high school, I took a drama class.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah, and we actually came here to UL to do the finals where, you know, whoever's best. And everybody had, like, these real heavy-duty Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, you know, these real deep dramas and stuff all day long. And we come along, and I'm a senior in high school, and our teacher just goes, we're going to do an Uncle Remus Burr Rabbit thing, and you're going to be the fox. We had a black girl play the white rabbit.
Oh, Lord.
And, of course, I was 18, you know, I'd blown a grade in high school, so I turned 18. Then you could drink. So what do? We go to the keg to get a drink before we go.
No,
oh yeah, I'm going disaster.
You
know, we're in Lafayette. They said it's a party town. You come from Lake Charles, you know, and we're going like, yeehaw, we're out of school. And I'm going, oh, should we do this? Oh, whatever. Well, we didn't get. It was like one drink and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do the movie, and Mick Cushing, the big guy, plays the bear. He's got this big plastic club, and the lady said, "When if you go to UL and they don't like your stuff, they're gonna let you know." We're going on with Uncle Remus following William Faulkner. You know, this is gonna be bad. And so Mick's thing is he's supposed to hit me at a certain time, and so. He hits me, and he wallops the heck out, and I literally saw stars, and I'm beaten out, and everybody is laughing their butts off, and I'm beaten out, and I'm going like, I think I'm going to pass out, but they're laughing, so this is good.
And you pursued it anyways
and
after
and
that
so I'm
experience.
Going, I like this, and then we got the top honor or something like that. I'm going,
Lord.
I don't know how that happened. I said, the audience must have been
that's great.
ready for that, you know, some slapstick at the end of the day. So.
Well, let's listen to we're going to listen to another cut.
Yeah.
And just so you want to look at Victim of a Broken Heart? You want to do that one?
Yeah.
The second track?
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us?
If we have time, are we going to have time for Isha Patricia as well?
We're going to have time for this one and one more.
Okay.
So
well,
you're going to have to X
one
out.
Then we'll do that. We'll do Victim of a Broken Heart now then.
Okay. All right. Let's listen to that, Cecil. That was Double Dog, Victim of a Broken Heart. And that was some other folks with my guest today, Dale Parity, on The Exchange. Dale, I'm curious. Now, you did some of the writing of that song,
the lyrics. Along all these songs, I've had some part in it.
Had you done that prior
to
this?
Never with anybody else. Like I said, I've got a bag full of stuff that is all kind of stream of consciousness, just writing it down. I didn't edit too much.
Sure.
That I wanted to be songs, you know, but they were just poetry. I just do that just to please myself.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll improvise. I'll remember a few lines, and if we're singing something, I'll just kind of improvise on it, that kind of thing. But no, and this is what's good about it. It's kind of forcing me to go, okay, now it's time to do some homework here.
Sure, sure.
And whittle it down and facet the jewel, you know.
I'm curious for you in how – you know, what comes out of you, is there just creative things constantly throughout the day coming out, whether it's visualizing something you're going to sculpt or
it's
music?
Usually, I read a lot. You know, one of the things was high school, although I did terrible in my grammatical parts of English, I'd always get, your ideas are great, you get an A, but your grammar is a U. You get the A in the best grade and the worst grade. So
sure,
I was like, oh, how am I ever get this stuff out if I can't do proper grammar? But you didn't get that. But so a lot of the stuff I read in high school, you know, Henry David Thoreau, you read all the American authors, the English poets. So I had a lot of influence like that. And I love to read biographies about people. Or famous quotes, that always sparks off some kind of a thought. Or I'll just come up with my own. Mick Jagger said he always kept a little book. He said, you're going to forget it if you don't write it down. So you keep a little book. It might only be two lines or four lines, but that might be your whole germ of the song right there that you have. And so that's how ideas come, you know. And you just got to write them down because you're probably going to forget them, you know.
Yeah. And I would think for you there's like so many different ideas that come out.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's lyrics for a song or the next piece I'm visualizing that I want to make.
I guess that's the thing I like about it. It's always the next new thing, you know. I'm trying to find something new or a different way to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the great pleasure. That's the art, the discovery, you know.
Sure, yeah.
It is the fun part.
Yeah, that's, you know, I want to step back for a minute to what we were talking about with you in film. You also were in Zach Gottschall's production of Lord Byron.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord Byron got some great notice.
Yeah,
that
they've
film
got it
did.
To the Sundance Film
that's
Festival.
Right.
And I always wanted to be there. I went to Sundance one time, and Glenn Petrie had just left there the day before.
Oh, okay.
It was one of my unsynchronous moments there.
Sure.
But I said, well, I came to the Mecca. This was it because I loved what he was doing.
Yeah. And Zach has a really interesting way that he works and directs. I mean, a lot of times there's a lot of improvisation in terms of of what the script is.
Yeah, he just gives you the basic idea of what's going to happen. And with video now, you can shoot a lot. So but somebody's got to go through and edit all that too.
Yeah.
But Zach was real easy to work with. Not only that, but if I had an idea, you know, because I was doing my stuff, I'm used to these independent filmmakers don't have much money to do their thing. And, you know, a lot of these things I do for free because if I see you've got something, I'm going to help you out.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can let me kind of do a little of my thing in there, too, as part of my pay is to throw my ideas in, then I'm satisfied.
Sure.
Even if they don't get used. And so that's the fun part of working with Zach was to be able to do that, throw an idea out and go, yeah, do that, you know.
Yeah.
And but my scenes got cut. All my lines got cut and everything. He said, Dale, I had to cut all that. He said,
they
but
did.
The three scenes you're in are very powerful because I play the shaman who's using
that's
the bull roar in the film.
That's right.
And I'm supposed to be evil incarnate. And so so the scenes that I am in are very good and very powerful. So.
And that was all filmed in this area too.
Yeah, and I helped with some filming on the bayou. The scenes out Lake Charlotte, and so that was fun because the scene that you know is where the kind of the hobo camp, as you call
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah.
They're real hobo camps. Lafayette, you'd go under there's people living under a bridge, there's graffiti, and there's like a whole underworld.
That's right.
That's hanging out. And then these little encampments where people would go, and little transients, I guess, in wintertime, people would go and stay at these camps. And we'd clean the trash and we'd look, hey, look, there's a camp. And there's like, you know, there's tents, there's bicycles, there's a fireplace, there's a little grill to cook food, you know, there's clothes hanging up. You know, it's like a little a Hooverville.
Sure, yeah.
And so that was trying to put the authenticity into things.
That's right. And then you mentioned, too, now you've been involved with Jerry McGee's latest, with the film that he's actually putting together based on Amadei Arduin. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
And his dad, Dennis McGee, right. And Jerry, you know, this is his first, you know, directing
for him
debut.
To do it, yeah.
But it's a story he always wanted to tell because we had a beautiful thing happen with that. And, of course, in the 70s, you know, when the funk and the music was all combining together and, you know, everybody was exchanging ideas and music thing. And the story about Dennis McGee and Amadei is that, you know, here we got Amadei, you got a black man and a white man playing both French music, but a little different version of Creole playing with the Cajun playing.
That's right.
And also at the time, you have other influences coming through Louisiana, you know, country western music, whatever. But they were playing these gigs in the 30s. They went to record New Orleans, a bunch of recordings. And they would play these things under threat, bodily threat. You know, sometimes they had to carry brass knucks or a gun. Or
that's right.
You might get in a little scuffle. And unfortunately, that did happen. Then the facts are a bit unclear, but the main fact, regardless of who did it or what did it or for what reason that it happened, because if people don't know, he was beat up after a performance. Supposedly, some woman handed him a handkerchief to wipe his sweat, and some guy lost his cool, and they found him after the show and beat him up. He never was the same.
Yeah.
He lived and died in Pineville Mental Institution, basically a vegetable. And it was just real sad because here we had something that showed a unity of the same thing. You know, we got the
That's
same
right.
thing, but it's a little different. And adding those two things, it made something better in you.
That's right.
You know, and the better part of maybe even just not besides the music is that, you know, showing that, hey, look, we can not only get along, we can make things, we can make something better come
That's
out
right.
of things. You
That's
know?
Right.
And so I think that's a real important. So hopefully we'll finish the movie before the end of the year and get to see it.
And Jerry's playing his dad.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Andrew Hunter is playing Amadei.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you doing with the film?
Well, I'm the bad guy.
Oh, you are?
Again.
Ah.
Yeah. It pays the same. It pays the same as good guys. So. And so that's my part in the film.
Yeah. That must have been a fun process working with all them on that production.
Yeah, because once again, you know.
And everybody's learning.
Yeah, everybody's learning. And it's good when you can feel free, like you don't have any stress on the set. It's already stressful enough doing films, and the director's got the big load on his back.
Sure.
He's got to answer all the problems for everybody. So it's fun when you can say, look, I'm going to do this. Well, how about if I do this? Or oh, that didn't work. But, you know,
yeah.
I get to try your idea anyway.
That's right.
Sometimes there aren't good ideas. Sometimes just letting you do it just to do it.
Yeah.
But you never know. You see it.
Because you don't
dance.
Know what comes out of it. You know?
You just don't know.
Yeah.
The music going to be there this time.
Yeah.
All you can do is do the best, you know.
So where does your creative being go from here? What you working on now?
Well, I hope one of these days I can do my own film. It's called Fire on the Bayou, about the early years of the oil industry and the rice farmers, not too far from, we're near Pointe-Aux Springs, where my grandmother's from, actually. Was the Springs, pre-Civil War, people would come out of the New Orleans for the yellow fever, and they'd come out and hang out here. And people would go on fishing trips, hunting trips, whatever, and they were taking care of little cabins. But you could also camp out. This is the Springs. Jean Lafitte once went there. The Indians went there. People would bathe in it, get rid of skin diseases. It was healing waters. But unfortunately, the drilling from the oil fields struck salt water and messed with the aquifers and destroyed the aquifers.
Sure.
So in my story, part of it is the Gree-Gree woman, whatever you want to call it, the Mojo Mama,
has
this prophecy. And this is about this turtle that has been buried near the springs, when the salt water would come into it, would come up. And actually, giant loggerhead snapping turtles can metabolize oxygen through their skin. Some guy in Gretna buried 250-pound turtles for a year, and they only lost like 5 pounds of body weight. So they're like the Methuselah. They just can live on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's the sign that things are changing, you know. And, of course, we still have, you know, problems with these kind of things in our aquifers. You know, we our precious water here, what makes our wonderful climate here in Louisiana.
Yeah, you're very connected to what's natural.
Yeah, through my grandfather. You know, my dad didn't like to hunt. We fished sometimes. He wasn't much of a hunter and all that.
Yeah.
But my grandparents, grandfather, very patient. I just remember going to hunt and fish with my grandpa. We'd find a bait, little frogs right there. That's what we used. And I remember one time digging for worms, and my grandpa says, "There's no worms anymore." You know, I could see things change. My uncle's fine. They're spraying the rice, and now the chickens are deformed, and there's not any more birds, the mosquito hawks, the dragonflies. You know, start to see things. I mean, this is like quickly happening.
Sure.
You know, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. I'm going like, you know, we need to see. And because the Cajun culture was so linked in with that, and working as communal efforts and doing things, and the uniqueness that it is here in Louisiana. And so that, although I don't speak Cajun French, I got the feel of what
That's
it was.
Right.
That the, and plus just the piece of mind. I remember sitting on the front porch of my grandpa during a rainstorm. I'm just sitting there in the rocking chair. Nobody's saying nothing. Just dig it. You know, the peace.
Yeah.
The peace.
That's right. That's right. Well, you have the screenplay you're working on. You have it. You're typing it. You're writing it.
No, I'm going to leave that. I tried that too. ADD. It's a bad title. I like to call it artist discovering direction.
Yeah,
I think it sounds better. We don't like to call it torture. We like to call it compliance incentive, you know? So I'm hoping that Brooke Shamimi, my niece, who I've kind of been watching over all these years grow and all her talents, is going off to New York Film Academy in about a month.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And she's going to meet people there that know how to do these kind of things, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe she'll have a part
you
in the movie.
It.
But she
yeah.
has dreams of her own that she, you know, that may or may not happen.
Sure.
You know, sometimes it's best, I might end up just putting in a song in a short video, you know, if I can't do a movie about it. But I think it's a really good movie about this area and the great change that
yeah.
we went through, changing from the you know, agrarian to the oil-based things.
Exactly.
And so we're still fighting that thing and still trying to keep our culture intact as well.
Very cool. Well, Dale Parity, it'll be interesting to see what all has come out of you in the next year. You know? I mean, seriously.
Right.
You can find out more about Dale and see his work actually at his Facebook page. It's gives you a real good idea of what he's been doing with Boussiage and keep you up to date on all of his projects. So it has been a pleasure having you on here today.
It's
keep
been fun.
Creating.
A lot of fun. I'm glad you invited me.
Yeah.
It was a last-minute thing. Worked out just fine for me.
Fabulous.
So
me too. Thanks to Danny Kimball on that one.
All right, Danny.
We're gonna go out listening to the song Big Bubba. And again, this is Double Dog. Everybody have a great week.
Media designed to keep your obedient sleeping. Many people will see the video vampire soaking up the scene. Ain't it obscene? Hey, big brother, your paranoid police. Always at war, never ending peace. Leaping lemons to the sea in my conformity. Shipping the banks as your master seats. I can't take your heart. It's like a big defeat.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And is this news?
I didn't always want to go to the senior center because I have arthritis and my arthritis began to hurt. And I didn't want to go there and play bridge. It was much more fun to go shoplifting.
Bringing you all the parts of the world that don't fit into the daily news programs. Go out of your way for it. This American Life from Public Radio International.
7 p.m. Wednesdays on KRVS.
This is Bob Gushereau inviting you to tune in to the music of yesteryears every Tuesday night at 7. We'll listen to music from the great composers from the first part of the last century, done by performing artists then and the contemporaries of today, with a variety of music from my library and the library of many of my friends. That's the Music of Yesteryears, Tuesday nights at 7, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.